Okay, well, want to welcome everybody, and if this is your first time with us tonight, especially, we want to welcome you guys. Couple things I want to let you know. We do have an attendance sheet over there at that first table where you walk in, and there's also a handout there that you can get some notes, so you can take notes. And if you have missed any of the classes that have gone before, we do record every night, and we post that up on the website, so you can find that at htchurch.com/genesis. So if you go there, you can listen to the previous lessons, and they're also in the podcast, and you can get the notes of those as well. And now that we're all here, crammed into this room, very happy to let everybody know that they are moving us out as of next week. So we're going to be in the larger student cafeteria. So that is out by the security guard's desk. If you know where that is, by the bathrooms over there. And you kind of go around the security guard to the left, and there's a very big dining hall right there, which can seat probably about 200 people. So you will no longer have to sit on each other's laps unless you're married and you want to. So, but if you're not married, well, even if you're married, you could wait, right? But so we're happy about that. So we'll help you. We'll help you find it next week if you can't find it. If you come in the main entrance, just go straight up to the security guard and just hang a quick right around them, and you can't miss the big dining hall. It's the first room there, so lots of room. So I just want to thank everybody for their patience. I know sometimes people come and then they drop out for a little bit because, you know, the hassle, or they don't want to sit on somebody's lap maybe. So space hopefully will not be an issue going forward. So we're glad about that. So we just thank you for your patience. So we are moving with lightning speed tonight. Usually we move at the speed of a snail, but tonight we're actually going to attempt to get through two chapters. Can you believe this is an unheard of feat in the annals of this class? So the last time we were together, we saw that Jacob he's heading back across the river into the promised land, and he is wrestling with the angel of the Lord. And so he is now prepared for whatever may come, as best he can be in his human frailty. He's prepared, or at least as prepared as he's going to be. And so the big confrontation with his brother Esau is coming. So that's where we're picking it up at the beginning of Genesis 33. Moses says, "Now Jacob lifted his eyes, and behold, there Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants, and he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last." So now the big moment is here, and Jacob has divided the family up, and he's sending them across in groups. So, you know, Moses, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, is a brilliant writer. And we've said a lot of times there is nothing here in Genesis that is given to us by accident. And certainly there's nothing that's insignificant. So I want you to notice with me this detail that he puts the concubines and their children out front, and then followed by Leah and her children, and then finally Rachel and Joseph. So again, Jacob is trying to protect as best as he can that which is nearest and dearest to his heart. So Moses here is using foreshadowing very skillfully, and he's showing us seeds of trouble that lie ahead in the family relationship. So there is a clear favoritism here towards Rachel and Joseph, and you can imagine that the others, particularly the sons who are out in front, like, how would you like to be, you know, like a 15-year-old Simeon and be riding out here with the bullseye on your chest in front of 400 men? So these other parts of the family must, of course, have felt slighted and perhaps even unloved in comparison. So that is setting the stage for what's to come. So in verse 3 it says, "Then he crossed over before them, and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Remember, he's been showing him a lot of deference, right, in how he addresses him and so forth. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, "Who are these with you?" So he said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." Then the maidservants came near, they and their children, and bowed down. And Leah also came near with her children, and they bowed down. Afterward, Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down. So Jacob has already displayed humility, right, to Esau by sending him gifts and by referring to him as Lord and Master. Now he gives this very powerful display of deference by bowing 7 times. And this is probably the type of bowing in that part of the world that you would do to a superior, like a lord or a king, as you approach them. But perhaps to everyone's total surprise, Esau comes running, not with the sword that he was known for, but he comes running to hug his brother, and he embraces and even weeps with Jacob. So for Esau, it turns out, surprisingly, that this is actually a wonderful homecoming. So while Jacob has been praying and worrying, the Lord has done some kind of work in Esau's life and has turned his heart towards Jacob. Now, I think we just, because of the way the story rolls out, I think we just have to accept this at face value, that Esau is genuinely surprised that Jacob has blossomed into what he has become. Jacob has clearly become a wealthy man with a big family and a lot of servants, and he just seems to be so dumbfounded by this that he asks these ridiculous questions. Who are these? Like, who are these people? Like, it blows his mind. And so notice Jacob again refers to himself as the servant of Esau, and whether it's completely sincere or not, or whether it's just trying to stay alive, notice that everybody continues on in this extreme deference following Jacob's lead. Everybody's bowing to Esau. And so now there's this politeness contest that they're going to have. Starting in verse 8, it says, "Then Esau said, 'What do you mean by all this company which I met? And he said, "These are to find favor in the sight of my Lord." And you can kind of feel Esau's eyes like rolling a little bit at this point now. But Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." And Jacob said, "No, please. If I have now found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I've seen your face as though I'd seen the face of God, and you were pleased with me. Please take my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." And so he urged him, and he took it. So Esau questions the gifts that Jacob has sent over, and Jacob plainly says that they are to win his favor. They are to show kindness, and as we've discussed, they are meant to pacify Esau. And Jacob refers to them as a blessing. He uses just the ordinary Hebrew word for a blessing. He says, "I just want to bless you with this." So Esau says, right, that he himself is also wealthy, or at least satisfied with what he has, and he doesn't need anything. He has also been able to accumulate quite a lot. He was able to ride out to confront Jacob with 400 men, which is pretty amazing, right? We don't know who these men are. Maybe they are just the friends and servants and sons that he's acquired over the last 20 years, because as we'll see, he's been busy acquiring wealth, and he's been busy making sons himself. Maybe they are also the servants of Isaac. So we have to remember that even though these people are advanced in years, right, Isaac is still alive at this point. He's very advanced in years, and Isaac had been extremely wealthy. So maybe Isaac had given, the lion's share of his gifts, of his income, let's say, and goods as gifts to Esau. But in any case, Jacob, it's kind of cute here. He replies that it's so good to see Esau, that seeing him is like seeing the face of God. Now, I think this is a little joke that Jacob is kind of making between himself and the Lord. Because, of course, what is he thinking about when he's saying that? He is thinking that he has just seen the face of God in a place that he named the face of God. And now he's telling his brother, seeing you like this is like seeing the face of God. It's like having, that means the ultimate in favor, unexpected favor that I could have. And interesting, right? Jacob now breathing this sigh of relief. God moved in Esau's heart while he was at the same time straightening out at a deeper level some of these character issues that Jacob had while Jacob was what? Looking into the face of God. And that's where our character issues will get straightened out as well. And also, the word tells us that when a man's ways please the Lord, what? He makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. So it's a really interesting dynamic there. And it's kind of, I think, like a little in-joke between Jacob and the Lord that he says that. And Jacob says, well, I have enough too. So just take this as a gift from me. And finally, he relents and he takes the gift. So this is really, it's a little bit of an awkward exchange, and it's kind of a diplomatic dance, right? So in that culture, you never really would take a gift from an enemy. You would only take a gift from a friend. So the fact that Esau takes this gift from his brother means that in front of all these people, he's giving the sign, right, that this is truly a friendship that's being restored. And so now from now on, he really has to treat Jacob as his friend, because all these people have seen him receive all of this significant sum of wealth from Jacob. So now it gets a little more interesting, because, you know, you can be nice to people, but that doesn't mean that you should be with them in life and go with them necessarily. So this is a decision point for Jacob, but Jacob is non-committal because he knows he has his own destiny in God to accomplish. So verse 12, Esau said, "Let us take our journey. Let us go, and I will go before you." But Jacob said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are weak, and the flocks and herds which are nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard one day, all the flock will die." Now that was probably true. Yeah, you know, Jacob wasn't riding out for war or confrontation or for safety. He was leading all of his family and possessions. So that wasn't deceptive or disingenuous on his part. But he says, "Please let my Lord go on ahead before his servant. I will lead on slowly at a pace which the livestock that go before me and the children are able to endure until I come to my Lord in Seir." And Esau said, "Now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Like, why do we need to do that? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Succoth, built himself a house, and made booths or tents, tabernacles for his livestock. And therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. Now, so Jacob, right, you see what's happening here. Jacob is very glad, obviously, at this unexpected turn of events. But that doesn't mean that he trusted Esau or that he wanted to have a close alliance and start living as one big happy family. He did not want to travel together with Esau, and he did not want any of Esau's people to remain with his people. That might have been risky. Some of them might have been spies, you know, to scope out what Jacob possessed. They might also have had designs on the women. Just fact of life. So Jacob seems to have decided that it would be best to just be friends, but let's not stay too close to each other. You know, sometimes if you hang out with some of your old friends when there's been trouble in the past, you know, old wounds can come back up to the surface in conversation. And Jacob was leery of that. The one thing that Jacob could not afford to do in a conversation with Esau is kind of get into a conversation like, "Hey, remember the time?" You know, Jacob could not afford for that to happen. And so it was probably wise for him to exercise caution. It's also been pointed out, you know, a lot of people have noticed that Jacob was acting a little bit like his old self here, because he did indicate to his brother, "Yeah, I'm going to join you down in Seir where you hang out." But what did he do? He went the other way instead. He ended up in Succoth, which means rooms or tabernacles. It means places to dwell. So he doesn't want to travel with Esau. Why? Because he's looking for places to dwell for himself. He doesn't want to be beholden to anybody else or get, you know, too much intertwined with Esau such that it's going to become difficult to pull apart at a later date. So we will also find out a couple chapters down the road that the land actually wasn't big enough to support the two of them. And so Esau actually didn't mind that Jacob went his own way because they would have been in each other's space. But I still think Jacob was being careful. We don't know, but maybe he had a word from the Lord to continue on to his family's former dwelling places, because that's where he ends up. But it's very significant because all along the way, what have we seen? Throughout Genesis, every time there's trouble, there's a covenant that gets made. Could be with Abraham or Isaac and some pagan kings. Jacob even made a covenant with his uncle slash father-in-law. But this is really interesting because this is the first anxious encounter we've ever had, I think, where there's no covenant that is made. So they must have decided, this is cool, we're friends, we're brothers, we don't need to make a covenant. And that's a really good sign. So verse 18 now, Jacob's going to come in for a landing. So it says he came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram, and he pitched his tent before or in front of the city. And he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And then he erected an altar there, and he called it El Elohei Israel. So Jacob comes to Shechem, and he resumes the good old habits of his grandfather Abraham by not living in the city, right? He does not go to the Motel 6 or anything like that. He's going to dwell in tents outside the city. And in order to do that, in as unmolested a fashion as he can, he goes and wants to buy a little piece of land for himself for 100 pieces of money. We have no idea how much money that is. At this period of history, coins had not even been invented yet. So when they had transactions, yeah, coins came in about 1000 BC. So at this point, when you had to do a transaction like that, it was usually by weight. So this was probably some approximate weight, or probably bars, that were cut, things like that. So we don't know exactly what we're dealing with here, but he buys it from the offspring of Hamor. And these are Canaanite people, and the people who were, let's use the word, it's maybe a little early to use it, but Hebrew people, wandering people like Jacob, would have wanted to stay away from them, right? In his ears would have been his grandfather Abraham's story about Sodom and how you should really not hang out, in Canaanite cities because they're full of wickedness. And so Jacob probably would have considered these people to be very immoral. Certainly they were idol worshipers, and they certainly would have had many practices that Jacob would have found repugnant. So in all the cities of the Canaanites, there would have been sacrifices even of people at times, along with lots of sexual practices that he would have found repugnant. So this gets a little confusing here, because Shechem is the name of the place or the region, and it's also the name of the person who figures very consequently in this story, the son of Hamor. So as long as we remember that, we'll be all right. But Shechem was a very important place to the family. Shechem was really a headquarters, or one of the headquarters, for the patriarchs. And if you remember this, this goes all the way back to when we started talking about the patriarchs, when we turn that corner in Genesis 12, and we start talking about Abraham's call into the land. Shechem was Abraham's first stop in the promised land. That's where God first appeared to him after he called him and started rolling out more and more of the covenant to Abraham. So Shechem is where God appeared to him and said, I am going to give you and your descendants this land. So that's where that happened. So Jacob, again, is always calculating, and he says, well, this would probably be a good place for me to start out. Because if this is the place where God appeared to Grandpa and told Grandpa that we're going to own this place. So that's where I'm headed. So, but the problem is they are few in number, right? And the land, this is a, at this time, forget now, right? Forget what is happening in the land now. Forget the appearance of the land now. The climate has changed a lot. This was extremely desirable, extremely fertile real estate in this time. So you're talking about, this is about, let's say, about 1800 BC. And even up in the time of Moses, so many, let's say 450 or so years later, God says it's still a land flowing with milk and honey, right? You don't have milk and honey unless you have a lot of rainfall, you have a lot of grass, you have bees, and so forth. So forget what you think of desert, right? When you think of this territory now, that's not what's happening here. So this was a very wealthy area that everybody wanted. Everybody fought over it. The Egyptians wanted control. The Mesopotamian powers wanted control of this area. And so Canaanites are everywhere. And Shechem is a Canaanite city. It's a very ancient city, one of the oldest. We have tablets and things talking about how they were fighting with the Egyptians, and the Egyptians were trying to conquer them not long before this, about 1850 BC. So the land of Canaan, if you weren't with us when we had that discussion, kind of corresponds to what is Israel today, plus the Palestinian territories, plus it would go up a little further north. So the land of Canaan is like kind of from the border of Egypt down here, all the way up into what for us is now Syria, almost into Damascus. Abraham had traveled at least a little bit through that entire area, and God promised him that entire area. Now, we don't know if Isaac and Jacob ever did explore that area, but Abraham was familiar with it. So who are the Canaanites? They're just really comprised of a number of small tribes that probably have similar culture, similar languages, similar gods, but they would in time be united by one thing, and that's their hostility towards the people of Israel. Hamor was a prince or a king of one of the Canaanite peoples who are called the Hivites. Now, you know, when we read the Bible, we always joke about all those ites, right? There's Jebusites and Perizzites and Hivites. So the Hivites are one of the ites. And these folks lasted a long time, many hundreds of years past this, up to the time of Joshua, because they were in the list of nations that they were going to dispossess from the land. And they even lived all the way up to the time of Solomon. Solomon used some of them as servants and so forth. And then they disappeared. I find when I read these things, you know, there's some good takeaways even from thinking about little sideline stories like that. You know, think about how good and patient God is with the human race. So here's a tribe of people. They're not around anymore. But, you know, they were Canaanites. They probably did human sacrifices and things when the crops failed and things like that. They were not nice people. And God was so patient with them. I mean, who knows what messengers or prophets he ever sent to them to try to get them to follow the right way. But he was reaching out to them. They were living there with Israelite people in the land for 800 plus years that we know of before they disappeared. That's patience. That's graciousness on the part of our God, who will not, you know, have any to perish, but would desire all to be saved. So think about that. That's amazing. Jacob begins his stay in the Promised Land by building an altar now at Shechem. So he's come full circle, like I said, because he's in the same place where Abram built his first altar. And, you know, in order to be blessed, sometimes we need to go back and we need to do the first things, don't we, that we started out doing? That's what Jesus said to the church at Ephesus. You need to repent and do the first works. And Jacob, I think, is trying to do things right this time. I mean, it's always good to consecrate any new endeavor that we're doing to the Lord. And I think the fact that he fell into the good habits now of Abraham and Isaac means he's trying to walk on the straight path. And he calls this altar by this name, El Elohe Israel, which means God the God of Israel. And I think there's a little bit of outreach here on Jacob's part. This is a statement. First of all, it's a statement about who he is now, that he is starting to use his new name of Israel. But I think it's a little bit evangelistic, and I think that's commendable. I think that you notice in people, whenever they really start to get on track with the Lord again, it becomes very natural and very immediate that they start to reach out to people and tell other people about the Lord as well, because there's an overflow. So I just find it interesting that as soon as Jacob has got his act together, probably more than it's ever been in his life, he's in the right place, he builds an altar, and he gives it a significant name. So if you were with us earlier on, you may remember that the generic name for God in that part of the world is El. El was the name that the Canaanite people used to refer to the high God or the creator God. Doesn't mean that that was the only God they worshipped, but El was kind of over all these lesser gods. So when the God of Israel revealed himself to people, he didn't reveal himself as El. He allowed people to call him that, but he revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by his covenant name of Yahweh. And so what is Jacob doing here? I think by naming this altar El, the God of Israel, Jacob was saying, this God whom you worship as El, he's my God. And I've met him. And I know about him. Now, we can't be sure about this, but it's certainly a conversation starter, right? Why would he name it this? It would have provided him with opportunities to tell people how he had come to know God in a real way and explain how God had acted in his life in a dramatic fashion. But I don't think that Jacob had the immediate impact on the area that he maybe would have liked to have, as we find out in Genesis 34, which is really one of the most startling and appalling chapters up till now, because just when you think that things are starting to percolate and really go well, there's lots of trouble. Verse 34 tells us the story of Dinah. It's really Dinah, but you know, in English, we'll call her Dinah. And she is the only daughter that we know of by name. Doesn't mean that there weren't others, but boys seem to have been the thing in that family. But Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. His soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this young woman as a wife. All right. Well, this is the second time that we've heard Dinah mentioned in Genesis. The name Dinah means judged in the sense of being vindicated or being acquitted of something. And probably, knowing the history of the women in the family, I would say that probably what happened is that Leah named Dinah the way she did as a part of her ongoing struggles with her sister Rachel. Naming her Dinah was Leah's way of saying that God has vindicated me, or God has judged me. He's given judgment for me in my struggle over my sister. So if you remember, you know, Leah was always naming people, you know, and Rachel, these two were having a war through their childbearing or lack thereof. So very sad story. Unfortunately, if you read some of the early writers, Jewish or Christian, you know, Dinah is sometimes criticized by early writers because she didn't stay home but went out to see the daughters of the land. So that's supposedly a warning against worldliness, but I think that's unfair, right? Because in essence, it's blaming her for being raped. But you have Shechem, who is no peach. He violates her, and then he says, I've got to have this girl. So father, don't you love teenagers, right? Father, get me this woman. So, you know, a lot of nerve. So then comes what I refer to as worst proposal ever. Verse 5 says, Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his livestock in the field, and so Jacob held his peace until they came. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved and very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife and make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it and acquire possessions for yourselves in it." Well, we don't know how Jacob heard about this, but now he's also in a terrible spot in a way. How is he going to react? He's a wanderer, right? And, he's got maybe 50 people with him at this time. How can he take an aggressive posture against a whole established city of Canaanites? So Jacob, and this is a real key to Jacob. Jacob is not at all like his descendant David. You will probably never see, I don't think you ever see, Jacob asking God what to do. You don't see that. Jacob is the type of believer, and may we never be like this. Jacob is the type of believer that walks well with the Lord when he is having experiences with the Lord, right? Jacob had some really cool experiences. You know, if God appears to you, God talks to you, then, you know, God throws down with you at the river. I mean, those are amazing experiences. And he's walking well with God when he's having experiences with God. But when there's trouble, you don't see what you would see, say, with a David. "And David inquired of the Lord, Lord, shall I pursue them?" And so forth. So you don't see that. You see a reaction, or you see calculation of using his own wisdom. In this case, he flipped around, probably because of the experiences with God he had. He flipped around almost completely now to the other side, to passivity, right? But he did not inquire of the Lord. So Dinah's name really becomes a play on words here. And you have to remember, because Hebrew names will pretty much always mean something, that those names are significant to understanding the story. If Dinah's name means judged or vindicated, her name becomes a play on words in this story. How is she going to get judgment now for herself? Who's going to step up? Who's going to vindicate her? Who's going to defend her? Jacob, you would think, should be a natural defender. He's her dad. He has apparently purposed in his own mind that he's not going to do anything without taking advice from his sons. So this is not the Jacob we know. This is Jacob who's a little rattled. Maybe it's because of his limp that he's no longer able to strap on a sword and go hunt somebody down. We don't know. But whatever the case, some of these guys, they're young men now in their own right. They're in their early 20s probably. And so he's leaving it up to them. Brothers could be the traditional defenders of their sisters in this society. If you remember back when Isaac went to get Rebecca for a wife, who was doing the dealing there? Who was involved? Was Laban. Was the brother of Rebecca. So it's interesting. Maybe he wanted to see what the brothers would do. Was he shirking his responsibility as a dad? Does he just doubt his own wisdom? We don't know, but there's something very disturbing about this. He hasn't yet really learned to go to God for wisdom, but he doesn't want to lean on his own self. And so he's checked out. He's just totally passive, and that's going to have major consequences, because now here comes Hamor, this king or prince of Shechem, and obviously what he proposes, worst proposal ever, is just adding insult to injury. My son raped your daughter, but boy, he's real sweet on her. I mean, who does that? So but that's what he's saying. You have to read this not as a religious story. You have to read this in terms of the reactions. Like if you're Jacob and if you're you know, his sons. And what are you feeling when this man's saying this to you? Like, are you out of your mind, right? So let's just intermarry, he says, and let's just become one big happy family, and we'll become one people over time. So then Shechem steps up, says to her father and her brothers, meaning Jacob and his sons, let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me, but give me the young woman as a wife. So now he makes it 10 times worse, because he turns it into a money thing, which has another terrible implication, right? But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father and spoke deceitfully, because he had defiled Dinah their sister. And they said to them, we cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. But on this condition, we will consent to you. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we'll dwell with you, and we'll become one people. But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we'll take our daughter and be gone. So, obviously, this young man is really inflamed with his desire for Dinah, and he's going to pay whatever is necessary to have her as a wife. And of course, that's going to be viewed as just another insult. But Jacob's sons have already devised a scheme, which Moses is about to lay out for us, right? They will agree to become one people with the Hivites if they get circumcised. So this was not the weirdest thing ever, because there were a lot of peoples in the area who practiced circumcision. So the Hivites might have said, well, okay, that wouldn't be choice number one, but it's, you know, but we'll do it. So verse 18, their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. He was more honorable than all the household of his father. So, you know, he's a rapist, but he's actually the best guy of the whole bunch. So this, you know, when I say that Israelites did not have a high opinion of Canaanites, I was not kidding, if that's the best one they've got. So Hamor and Shechem, his son, come to the gate of the city and speak with the men of the city. Now listen, there's money to be made here, right? This wealthy guy has just, with his cattle, has rolled into town saying, these men are at peace with us. Notice there's no mention of how this, you know, came to be. These men are at peace with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it. For indeed, the land is large enough for them. Let's take their daughters to us as wives, and let's give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us to be one people. If every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised, listen, will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us. And all who went out of the gate of his city heeded Hamor and Shechem his son. Every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of the city. So this is how low the state of Canaanite society is, right? So Moses says that this guy is the best guy, despite forcing himself on Dinah. And they go to the gate, Dad and Shechem, his son, and the gate of the city is where business was always conducted. That's where the elders sat to give judgment. That's where, if you had business, if I'm going to sell a cow to Tony, we go and we do the deal there, because there's witnesses there. And so they go down and they find all the prominent men of the city, and they say, this is what we're going to do. And you know, human nature being what it is, right? You can often convince people to do things that are painful if there's the promise of a big payoff at the end. And so they're all circumcised. So now it came to pass on the third day. So there's that third day again, right? We notice what we said. Every time there's a third day in Genesis and in many other places, it means that something has changed over. There's been a rolling over. There's a transition point. Yeah. So on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. And they killed Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword. They took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain, and plundered the city because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, their donkeys, what was in the city, what was in the field, and all their wealth. All their little ones and their wives they took captive, and they plundered even all that was in the houses. Wow. So this is self-explanatory. The entire offer, obviously, of circumcision was a ruse. Simeon and Levi kill the men. Now, these are some of the oldest ones, right, in the line. The men are unable to move about easily. We'll just leave it at that. And apparently, if you notice, the other brothers might have been too squeamish to kill, but they don't have any problem joining in the looting, right? And they take everything, even the people, as captives. Dinah's interesting detail here, right? We do not know if she herself was a captive or if she was there voluntarily, but in any case, I mean, this is obviously a zealous and gross overreaction to the rape of Dinah. Most civil governments at that time, if you had a functioning one, which the Canaanites was always questionable, I mean, if you were going to insist on the law, then, you know, Shechem ought to have been put to death for rape. That would have been normal in that part of the world at that time. But I mean, to murder and then bereave an entire city was shocking. I mean, that was something that other Canaanites will do. And, you know, there's always a price for these things, right? Nothing that you obtain like that can ever come with blessing. So, you know, before the end of Genesis, and it's really fascinating, all the way at the end of Genesis, before he dies, Jacob is going to prophesy. He's going to give his blessing and prophesy over all his sons. And when he does, and you'll remember when we get there in 2019, when he does, he's going to prophetically limit, by prophesying it under the leading of the Spirit, he is going to limit the future prospects of the tribes of Simeon and Levi by giving them a poor blessing. His words would come to pass because he prophesied that they would not have portions, those two tribes would not have portions in the promised land the same way that all the other tribes would. So there's no territory of Simeon. And Simeon over time just ended up getting absorbed into another tribe. Levi, God had some grace there, and the Levites continued on, but they have no territory. They are sprinkled throughout all over Israel. So that's amazing. The prophetic word that Jacob spoke over them followed them down all the way through their history. So then in verse 30, it says, Jacob then said to Simeon and Levi, "You've troubled me by making me obnoxious." Literally, it means you made me stink. So what he said, literally, "You've made me stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a harlot?" Well, of course not, but, you know, there's a way to handle things, right? So they are justifying themselves by saying that they've stood up for their sister's honor, but Jacob is looking at the bigger picture, and he says, you know, "You've made me stink, and now I'm going to suffer exactly what these folks have just suffered." And so it's really a terrible picture of the power of anger and rash decision-making when it gets away from you. And so, you know, Jacob now, who had the promise of being blessed by God, you know, he's not, apparently he hasn't had enough time with his own change of heart to instruct his own sons on how to live right. You know, and that happens sometimes, doesn't it, in the kingdom of God? You may be the first one in the kingdom, in your family, and yet, you know, what's in your life, the work of God that's in you might take a little bit longer to get into the lives of your kids or your relatives. And I think Jacob, you know, I wonder what Jacob was thinking here in his passivity and waiting to get counsel from these hotheads, and obviously did not, you know, interrogate them or see, you know, he, the deceiver, now has ended up for not the last time being deceived by his own sons, which is going to happen again and again. So, which is a terrible thing. So that's where we'll want to end it tonight. Sorry to end on such a dour note, but you know, not every sermon can be rah, 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 you know? So there's lots of good lessons to learn there, though, in that story. So, questions? Yeah.
I find it more normal, like I think about even in today's time, that they did go and kill those men. Because in today's time, from what I understand, if a sister is raped, they actually kill the sister for things that aren't, you know, in her control. And I don't know where that culture even came up with such a disgraceful
thing. It
seems to be more sensible to want to kill the person who raped the actual family member than to...
Well, sure. I mean, it's more natural in that sense that the... Obviously, the criminal is a more natural object of revenge, if you want to say it that way. I mean, that culture is something that's developed, you know, over time because of their own religious influences and traditions with the honor killings. So, but this obviously, these guys obviously absorbed an honor-based culture, where they are going to practice revenge, even on a mass scale. But this is you know, way off the charts, obviously. So, anybody else? Yeah, almost Chicky. Good question. Question is, what happened to all the wives that they took captive? Well, they were either sold, or else they would have been incorporated into the household, forced to be maids, servants, or maybe even concubines. So, and the kids too. We have babies that get raised up in the household from the time that they are infants as servants, or they would be sold. I mean, you know, we will see later when we get to Joseph. Joseph's brothers did not have any trouble quickly finding, you know, or doing business with some Amalekites to sell Joseph into slavery. So they obviously knew how the game was played in that part of the world. It was a very dangerous and lawless time to be alive, you know. So yeah,
so they asked Canaanites to be circumcised, not to be believers in God, mainly just physical act of
right. Just to trick them so that they would be too incapacitated to defend themselves. Yep. These were not nice guys. Again, you know, if reading Genesis is new to you, you know, remember that, you know, many of these stories are not here because God approves of this. They're here because they happened and God wants us to know what happened and draw the appropriate lessons from it. So... repeat that is not the lesson to be drawn, obviously. Yeah.
When Jacob told Esau that he was going to meet him in his land and then went the other way, is that looked at as a lie, like by God? Does God say it as a lie then?
I would think so. Fortunately, I don't think so. I think he was probably still afraid, because until everybody was safely gone in their own direction, Jacob couldn't be sure of his physical safety. Fortunately for him, Esau didn't really care. We don't find that out until a couple chapters down the road, when Esau actually does tell Jacob and say, you know, the land is too big for the two of us. So he probably sees Jacob as kind of a you know, commercial or financial threat, right? So he says, yeah, I don't care, whatever, he lied to me, but if he's down there, then he doesn't interfere with my operations up here, so whatever, leave him be. But yeah, he was being deceptive for sure.
Would there have been a better way to handle that situation from God's point of view?
Well, the best way probably would have been to ask God what to do and where he should settle, which he, again, was calculating. I mean, think what he did was good, but we're going to find out that God's actually going to move him to where God actually wants him to be. So he's doing what he knows to do, which is okay, but it's not the best. So, yeah, good question. Anybody else? Oh, Charles.
Maybe God had changed Esau's heart, and and that's why he didn't confront
mm-hmm.
Jacob. And the other thing about seeking God as far as what to do, maybe he would not have settled near the city of Shechem and avoided this whole episode.
Yep. Exactly. Well, that's what we're saying, that you know, that's why David is so much more of an admirable figure, because not always, but he made it his practice to inquire of the Lord, you know, and wait on the Lord. And so David is always saying that to us. And sometimes even doing the obvious things, I gave the example of, you know, fighting the Philistines, and the obvious thing to do would have been to chase down the beaten enemy and wipe him out. But instead, David says, shall I pursue them? So here's Jacob that says, well, I don't have a word from God. I'm not seeking God, but I know what to do. David says, I know what to do, and I'm capable of doing it, but I'm going to ask God first.
Amen.
Which is, yeah. So. Anybody else? How many of you don't like Simeon and Levi? Yeah. All right, well, hang in there, because you're going to like these guys even less and less over the next few weeks. So don't forget, next time we are moving over to this new classroom. If you want to see where it is, just go down the hall and walk around the corner. You can still come in this door. If you're coming in the main door where the columns are, just go straight to the security desk and then just go around to the right. But we'll help you get there. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you.